Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be free. In fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone should has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly historically has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. Hi, and welcome back. Here are a couple of straightforward questions for you. If the government may not establish a religion or favor one over the other, how can the military provide chaplains of various religious faiths to serve in several branches of the military? And here's another question. How can Congress and lower levels of government include prayer in their official meetings? This podcast will give you an overview of what the courts and traditions say about these questions. Let's start with military chaplains. The idea that clergy would be part of the military has a long history. Chaplains served in the Continental Army during the American Revolution. Congress authorized hiring the first official Army chaplain in 1791, so chaplains have been part of the U.S. military since the beginning of the country. But to satisfy the First Amendment religion clauses, there are some rules which chaplains and the military must follow. In a book titled Secular Government, Religious People, law professors Ira Lupu and Robert Tuttle outline the basic law of chaplains and the First Amendment. They write, quote, "First, chaplains are commissioned to provide religious service in accordance with the tenets of the religious community that endorsed them for the chaplaincy," end quote. This means a particular faith group must endorse a chaplain, that is, confirm that he or she is an ordained or accepted member of that faith. The military may not choose who applies or who is endorsed by a particular religion. This is intended to maintain the neutrality of government to prevent favoring one faith over another. Lupu and Tuttle write, "Both the endorsing religious organization and the candidate must understand and accept the military's pluralistic environment and the chaplain's role in light of that context," close quote. There is another level of responsibility chaplains must meet to serve. Lupu and Tuttle say, quote, "Second, chaplains provide commanders with advice and assistance in meeting the religious needs of all those for whom the commander has responsibility, regardless of religious affiliations. This means the clergy must agree to serve everyone in their unit, regardless of their faith, or if they have no religious belief at all. Chaplains then have a dual role. They serve as members of their faith and may conduct services in agreement with that faith. Those services must be voluntary for servicemen, however, and men and women may not be required to attend any service or honor any religious practice with which they disagree. The second role is to serve all the troops. They are commissioned officers in the various branches of the military, and their commanders may give them duties to perform, such as maintaining worship spaces, counseling all troops, attending official ceremonies, etc. It should be noted that the Army, Navy, and Air Force each has separate chaplaincy sections. The three have some differences, but all operate under the regulation of the Defense Department. So are military chaplains constitutional? The answer from the courts over the years is yes, but there are differing arguments about whether chaplains operate within the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, or if the military is unique because service members are a captive audience, that is, they can't just leave and they must obey orders. The government puts service people in harm's way and can order them to serve in far-off places where there would be little access to clergy or places to worship. Offering military personnel ways to worship and access to spiritual counseling is, then, a way to serve troops who would not be able to easily practice their faith in other ways. Law professors Lupu and Tuttle say that provides unique circumstances, and the military is providing an accommodation to serve the troops. The military is not endorsing any faith, but providing opportunity for the faithful to have some of their religious needs met. The concept of neutrality is important to keep in mind. As we said, the military is not supposed to favor any faith, endorse one over the other, or to coerce any member to practice a faith with which the member disagrees. Clergy may hold to the tenets of their faith. They are not required to do anything that offends their basic beliefs. On the other hand, they may not force their faith onto those who serve in the military. A recent example is the Supreme Court decision recognizing same-sex marriage. Some were concerned this meant military chaplains would be required to conduct wedding ceremonies for same-sex couples. This is not the case. In a column written for the military newspaper Stars and Stripes in 2012, retired chaplain Lieutenant Colonel Henry P. Roberson, who served as a Catholic chaplain in the U.S. Army for 30 years, wrote, "Chaplains exist, in other words, for the sake of the troops, not for themselves or for their denominations." Chaplain Roberson continues, "They serve all members of the military and their dependents, not just members of their own faith group." He writes, and I quote, "I served as a Catholic chaplain, but took care of everyone of any faith, little faith, or no faith. The motto of the chaplaincy is to perform or provide. On those rare times when I could not, for whatever reason, take care of the person, I referred them, usually by walking them down the hall, to someone who could take care of them. I never said no and left them adrift. It was my duty to make sure that they had what they needed. As a Catholic, I can't perform same-sex marriage, so I would find a chaplain who could do that. What I think of same-sex marriage does not matter. They have a right to religious support when legal." End quote from Lieutenant Colonel Roberson. To summarize, it's within the rulings of the First Amendment for the military to have paid chaplains, but the chaplains must serve all the troops. Specific worship practice is okay if that service is voluntary to those attending. The military and the courts are balancing the right to freedom of religious exercise by providing access to chaplains, while attempting to remain neutral in relation to the establishment or favoring of any specific religious belief or no belief at all. Let's move on to prayer at government meetings. May Congress or lower levels of government permit prayer as part of their official meetings? The short answer is yes, but the Supreme Court says there may be certain kinds of limits. As with military chaplains, there is a long history of prayer at official meetings of the government. The very first Congress authorized hiring a chaplain to offer blessings at the beginning of sessions. Over the more than 200 years since, there have been occasional challenges to this practice. One of the most important was a case called Marsh versus Chambers in 1983. It was about the state of Nebraska having a paid chaplain to offer prayer at legislative sessions. Before we explain that decision, it's useful to point out, before the legislative prayer case, the Supreme Court established an outline to decide if there was too much government entanglement with any religion by a government entity. In 1971, the High Court created a three-part test for determining when a law violates the Establishment Clause. This became known as the Lemon Test, after the name of the case that was involved. The Lemon case had to do with public funding of religious schools, not official prayers at legislative meetings. But the court decided that for a law to comply with the Establishment Clause, it must do three things. Number one, have a secular purpose. Number two, have a predominantly secular effect. And number three, not foster excessive entanglement between government and religion. But the court ignored their own Lemon Test in the legislative prayer cases and relied instead on history and tradition. The Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University analyzed the Supreme Court decision in the Marsh v. Chambers case. Here are excerpts from their analysis. Quote, in Marsh v. Chambers, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of legislative prayer. The case involved the Nebraska legislature's practice of beginning its sessions with a prayer led by a state-paid chaplain. In determining whether this practice violated the Establishment Clause, the court relied solely on the basis of historical practice, not the Lemon Test. The court observed that the practice of opening legislative sessions with prayer has continued without interruption for almost 200 years since the first Congress. Importantly, the court pointed out, the drafters of the First Amendment Religion Clause did not understand legislative prayer to be inconsistent with the First Amendment. 3 days after the first Congress approved appointment of paid chaplains to open sessions of the House and Senate with prayer, the same Congress approved the final language of the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment. The long history of legislative prayer in America, combined with the apparent interpretation of the Founding Fathers that such prayer was consistent with the First Amendment, led the court to conclude that the Nebraska statute did not violate the Establishment Clause. The court characterized legislative prayer simply as a tolerable acknowledgement of beliefs widely held among the people of this country. End quote. Okay, so official government assemblies may permit a prayer. But what if one prayer clearly favors a single faith? What if there is a pattern of legislative bodies only permitting the prayers of a local majority faith, and they exclude the views of other religions? The court in Marsh v. Chambers did not directly answer these questions, but in a case out of New York State decided in 2014, official prayer at legislative meetings was again supported by the Supreme Court. The case is called Greece, New York versus Galloway. And here's what happened. The town council in Greece, New York had a long-standing practice of inviting volunteer clergy, members of local churches, to say a prayer at the beginning of sessions. The record showed that they had invited exclusively Christian clergy, and prayers often referred to Jesus Christ. When there was a challenge to their practice, the council began to invite occasional non-Christians to say the prayers. Susan Galloway and Linda Stevens are local residents, and they filed a lawsuit against the practice. They cited the decision in Marsh v. Chambers, which suggested such prayers should be non-sectarian and to a generic God. The court majority ruled in favor of prayer in Greece, New York, with Justice Anthony Kennedy writing the opinion. The vote was 5-4. Now, Kennedy wrote in part, and I quote, The First Amendment is not a majority rule, and government may not seek to define permissible categories of religious speech. In rejecting the suggestion that legislative prayer must be non-sectarian, the court does not imply that no constraints remain on its content. The relevant constraint derives from the prayer's place at the opening of legislative sessions, where it is meant to lend gravity to the occasion and reflect values long part of the nation's heritage. Kennedy continues, from the nation's earliest days, invocations have been addressed to assemblies comprising many different creeds, striving for the idea that people of many faiths may be united in a community of tolerance and devotion, even if they disagree as to religious doctrine. The prayers delivered in Greece do not fall outside this tradition. End quote from Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy also referred back to the history of Congress approving a chaplain at the very beginning of its existence. He says, legislative prayer has become part of our heritage and tradition, part of our expressive idiom, similar to the Pledge of Allegiance, inaugural prayer, or the recitation of God Save the United States and This Honorable Court at the opening of this court's, that's the Supreme Court, sessions, he wrote. And he said there is no evidence that the Greece town council members allocated benefits and burdens based on participation in the prayer. That is, the court could find no indication that the council had favored any religion in its decisions about funding of governmental activity. He said the analysis would be different if town board members directed the public to participate in the prayers, singled out dissidents for opprobrium, or indicated that their decisions might be influenced by a person's acquiescence in the prayer opportunity. That's a quote. Now, one of the dissenters was Justice Elena Kagan. She, writing for four members of the court minority, wrote, and I quote, "For centuries now, people have come to this country from every corner of the world to share in the blessings of religious freedom. Our Constitution promises that they may worship in their own way without fear or penalty of danger, and that in itself is a momentous offering. Yet our Constitution," she continues, "makes a commitment still more remarkable, that however those individuals worship, they will count as full and equal American citizens. A Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, and so forth, each stands in the same relationship with her country, with her state and local communities, and with every level and body of government, so that when each person performs the duties or seeks the benefits of citizenship, she does so not as an adherent to one or another religion, but simply as an American." End quote from Justice Kagan. Of course, Justice Kagan and the other three justices in the minority did not prevail, and the Greece New York Council may continue withholding prayers at the beginning of its meetings. So, where are we? The court has ruled that even prayers from one religion do not violate the First Amendment if they are basically ceremonial in nature, and when the legislative body does not, then, favor in its decisions a particular faith. Since the Greece New York versus Galloway decision, a number of other cases have questioned the practice of prayers at official governmental functions. No other case has made it to the Supreme Court as of the time this podcast was recorded. We should make a final point. These cases do not engage the question of prayer in public schools. The Supreme Court has ruled that schools have a captive audience filled with students and teachers of various faiths or no faith at all. Official prayers in public schools are not permitted. Please understand the law changes, and a new case with a different set of facts or different justices may move that law in a new direction. That's all for today. Thank you for listening. Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh LaBella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.